Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. Ishmael Beya was one of 300,000 child soldiers worldwide, forced to the front lines of a civil war. He's one of 1,600-plus Sierra Leoneans who immigrated to the United States to escape the horrors of a war-torn country. Sierra Leone's civil war started in 1991 with an attempt to overthrow the government. The rebels, who were supported by former Liberian President Charles Taylor, took over diamond mines in exchange for weapons. He was not a librarian. And neither am I. Opposing armed groups formed, destabilizing the country. Rebel soldiers recruited children to join their side. Beya was conscripted by the army opposing the rebels. He first visited the United States as part of an envoy of former child soldiers selected to discuss his experience in the Army to a panel at the UN headquarters in New York City. When he landed at JFK, he walked outside, looked up at the sky, and thought, wow, it must always be Christmas here. The only time he had ever seen snow was in Christmas movies that aired on television in his homeland. At the UN, he met storyteller Laura Sims, who later became his guardian, and whom he calls his mother. Ishmael emigrated to the United States when he was 17, went to high school in New York, and graduated from Oberlin College, where he studied political science. His book, A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Child Soldier, is now, as of today, the number one on the New York Times bestseller list, which is pretty great. The book has rightfully been hailed as a classic firsthand account of war and the ongoing plight of child soldiers in conflicts worldwide. It is beautifully written, honest, disturbing, and inspiring. Ishmael is a member of the Human Rights Watch Children's Rights Division Advisory Committee, and I wanted to point out that tonight's program is co-presented with Human Rights Watch Young Advocates, and I wanted to thank them all for helping to get the word out. And also, you'll notice that they have a table of information out in the lobby, and you can pick up their literature and learn more about what's going on to combat child soldiers and to see what you can do to address this issue of abuse of children in war. Our format tonight will be in the form of a conversation, and after that, we will have the microphone circulating so that you can ask some questions, and then Ishmael will be signing his book in the lobby. Please wait till the mic comes to you so that we can all hear the question. And now please welcome Ishmael Beya. Evening.
Good evening. Hello.
You're glad to be in someplace warm, right?
Yes. Definitely changed from New York and other places I've been. Yeah.
Ishmael, the first time I met you was in 1991 when you came to my book reading in Denver, and we talked, and you told me that you were thinking of writing a book. It was in your mind at that time. So I'm trying to think of what it's like, what it was it like for you to carry around the story without having told it yet. Could you tell us a little bit about what that was like for you?
Yes, this was in 1999. I think I was in, I'd only been here for a little bit over a year, and I was in Boulder, Colorado with my mom, and we came to Denver. It was... When I first moved to the United States, I think my mom, you know, she and I talked, and we decided that, you know, I needed to not speak about my experiences then because I needed to be fully present in my new life so that I could gather the strength I needed. And if I decide that I wanted to speak about it, I would do that later on. So I didn't speak about it for a while. Even in high school, I went and spoke at NGO, you know, events, UNICEF and Human Rights Watch and things like that, but not, I didn't tell most of my high school friends and most of my college friends, except those who were really there to me. I just felt that it was not appropriate way of introducing myself to my high school friends. Hello, my name is Ishmael. I used to be in the war.
Right, right.
I didn't really think that would go off so well, you know. And also, I just didn't want people to limit their view of me through that, because if I introduce myself as that, that would be the only perception of me people will have. So I wanted people to get to see me for who I was, the Ishmael, not the Ishmael in the war. And then when those two Ishmaels are understood, then there's more to me than just the former child soldier.
You had told Laura, I mean, Laura knew most of your story, right?
Yes, my mom knew most of my story. When I was in high school, there were a few teachers who knew, but it never came up. But, you know, I went to school in New York at the UN school, and there are always young people in high school who pretend to be tough and, fascinated with this idea of being tough and violence and things like that. And I always laugh because I think when people are not truly touched, they haven't been truly touched by violence or anything, they have a fascination for it.
Mm.
But when you've been touched by it, you know that it's absolutely, there's nothing romantic about it. It only brings about suffering, and that's about it.
When you you were thinking of writing a book. When you were at Oberlin, was it through a process of mentorship? How did you start to let the story out, to work on it through writing?
Well, first of all, I think when I was doing a lot of the NGO speaking engagements, I realized that within the 20 minutes I would get on a panel, it was not enough for me to really explain what happened from my point of view, to really talk about this issue. So I started deeply thinking about it, but I didn't really start until when I went to Oberlin College during first year. I was afraid that my writing was not good enough for college, so I took a rhetoric and composition writing class.
Now, you had already, just to backtrack a little bit, you grew up speaking English. You studied it from a very early age.
Because Sierra Leone is a former British colony,
right.
So we like to think that the Queen's English is the best one.
and you were good at reciting Shakespeare.
As a kid, I was very fascinated with words and language. But, you know, growing up in a culture where your parents did not send you to school to learn literature or to be a writer, if you said that, no one would want to send you to school. When I was in Sierra Leone, I studied, I wanted to be an accountant and do it, you know, economics, but I knew that some point down the line that wasn't going to happen because I was absolutely terrible at math, even to this day.
Well, so, we're very lucky that you were.
But I knew English a little bit, but I perfected my English by being here, because back home I only spoke English in school, not at home. But here, you know, it's what I speak every day. And so at Oberlin, when I took this rhetoric and composition writing class, one of the assignments, the essay questions, was to write about how you played as a child.
Mm.
And I said, this would be interesting. But so I actually didn't write about how I played as a child during the war, that more of a deadly play, but I wrote about how I played before the war, inventing my own toys and things like that, because, you know, having your parents buy you a toy where I grew up was unheard of. And so people were fascinated with this world that I was describing that was so foreign to them. So I kind of got a sense that I would be able to bring that world alive. And so, but I didn't take it seriously. But during my junior year of college, I met a professor, Dan Shawn, who's a novelist
right.
Also, yeah. And so he took me under his wing because I had written a first chapter that became one of the chapters in the book about just running from the war. They workshop it in class, and I just, you know, remember how deeply affected certain people. So, and Dan Shawn said, you know, you should think about writing this. So he actually did trained me to sit down and write it, because I tried not to sit down and write it because it's too difficult to do. But as time went on, I realized the need for it.
So was the writing of it itself a way for you to relive some of those stories? I mean, was it a healing act for you to write it? I mean, I know you've said that you wrote it, you know, so that other people shouldn't have to go through this, or, you know, to bring attention. But in terms of your own process and your own path, was it, how did it affect you?
Well, for lack of a better word, it was therapeutic in a way. It made me understand certain things and come to terms with certain things. But it was very difficult to write the whole thing. You know, writing about the war was very difficult, obviously. But writing about what I had before the war was also difficult because I remember what I lost as a child when I wrote about it. So there was no easy way. But what gave me the strength to sit down and continue writing it is every time I would step away from it, I realized that as I was doing that, there was actually another child somewhere in the world that was actually experiencing that same thing at that moment. Mm. So that gave me the strength to be able to sit down and write it, because I wanted to expose this, to put a human face to what seems so distant to a lot of people.
Yes, very distant. And reading your book, which really is remarkable and painful. The first time I read it, you know, having met you and known you a little bit, you know, and then learning the story, you know, it made me ache, you know, for what you had been through. And I didn't, you know, we project, we imagine, but you don't really imagine. You don't know anything about what someone's been through in a war. You begin the book with, there were all kinds of stories told about the war that made it sound as if it were happening in a faraway place. And I made me think of other places where wars begin, like, you know, writing about Poland now, thinking about Poland, 1939, a peaceful village where my family lived, and all of a sudden, you know, there was the German invasion. But the day before was this very beautiful day, apparently a beautiful, perfect fall day. Now, it was far away to you. Did it seem far away to everyone in the village, to the adults as well?
Well, yes. First of all, the war started in Liberia, you know, and so we started hearing about that and the refugees coming into the country. And then when it started in Sierra Leone, because of how the culture, the community, how kind people were, and how just people have a deep respect for life and things like that. We didn't think that people in Sierra Leone could be capable of losing themselves the way they did and losing their humanity. So when we heard about these things, we could not believe that was really happening in our country. We didn't think it was possible. And, you know, until it really reached us, and some of us were forced to do certain things we didn't think we were capable of. And so, you know, I think, you know, oftentimes when these wars are presented out of context on televisions elsewhere, it almost seemed that, you know, people in Africa or other parts of the world are capable of doing that,
right,
and no
right.
one, and not elsewhere. But it's because people don't see what Sierra Leone was before the war. For a lot of people, the first time they learn about Sierra Leone is through the war. So their perception of that particular country is amputation, civil war, child soldiers. When you say Sierra Leone, it's not that for me. It's more than that. It's a place where I grew up. I spent time on the farm with my grandmother, listening to stories at night, you know, going swimming, being mischievous, listening to rap music, reciting Shakespeare, you know, and I have wonderful memories of it, but people don't get to see that.
No, you really made that come alive in the book. Your grandmother is a wonderful figure in the book. I love what she told you about the moon.
Yes.
How does that go?
I was in love with my grandmother, and, you know, even though I caused a lot of trouble on the farm, I was a very mischievous child, but the story about the moon is that there was an old man in Bandavulao, where my grandmother lived, and then later Kabati, who would always sit by his house when people going by to the farm or wherever they were going. He would say, always strive to be like the moon, try to be like the moon. And so my grandmother explained to me what this meant. It means that she said that when it's hot, people complain when the sun is too bright, when it rains, when it's cold. But when the moon shines, no one complains. Mm. People appreciate the moon in their own special, with children playing the light. Or people even say, oh, the moon is beautiful. Because of that, everyone should want to be like the moon, so that your presence actually pleases others. It makes others not feel at ease and not anything more. So
seems like the stories that you heard, you know, from your grandmother, and from, there was some wisdom also from your grandfather when you were in the forest, the snake medicine. I mean, many traditional stories you carried with you and were really part of your survival strategy.
Yes, because the way stories were very important part of the culture. It was a way that young people understood the history of a village. It was also a way you learned certain morals, certain things that you weren't supposed to do. And also, I think what I believe gives me sort of the strong memory and able to remember, and also just a flair for words, is that as a young person, you sit down around the fire and the adults would tell stories. Supposed to remember it and internalize it, and then 2-3 days later at another gathering, somebody will be randomly picked to retell a story that an older person had told, and you're supposed to tell it exactly word for word with all the hand gestures and everything. So you know that, and that was a practice to enhance memory, but also to enhance just deep listening. Mm. So as a child, you were aware of that, and also we're also very aware of nature. You know, the land, in the morning there were birds singing. So when all of that changed, you could feel it as a child. So.
And that idea of nature all through the book as a witness to what's going on is very poignant. I mean, the kind of the anguish of the trees you describe and the birds. I mean, you're very sensitive to that all the way through. It was.
Yeah, I mean, like a kid growing up in the morning, there were all kinds of birds that sang different times of the day. In the morning, they would chirp, and then, you know, at night, different birds, you know, owls would come out and things like that. But what happened during the war when the first gun was shot, when you hear echoes of gunshot in the distance, these birds were not present anymore. They were not singing. It became quiet. You could feel that nature itself was afraid of what was going on in this particular land. So. And as a child, having grown up to those sounds, and all of a sudden they were replaced by something quite foreign, you really felt the difference.
You could really feel it. Yeah. I wanted to, I know many of you here probably have, maybe how many of you have read the book already? Quite a few, and how many haven't? So there's also quite a few. Let's give the audience just an understanding of some of the sequence of events that you describe in the book. You were separated from your family. You were about 12, right?
Yes.
You and your brother Junior and some friends went to a nearby town for a talent contest, right? And you had some rap tapes in your pocket, and you wondered. Well, first of all, the rap was very important to us. Tell us a little bit about why you liked rap, or why were you carrying this around with you?
Well, you know, when I was growing up at age 8, we used to go to the foreigners' quarter. There was a mining town near where we lived, and so we would go to this quarter where the foreigners lived, you know, and they had the television. You know, we didn't grow up with electricity or tap water or anything like that. And we will try and swim in the swimming pool and things like that. So
they let you in?
They let us go in and do these things. I actually didn't like swimming in the swimming pool because it really, I couldn't smell the chlorine. I didn't like it. I liked the fresh water better.
Sure.
But, you know, one day we were there, and then this thing came on television, and there was a bunch of guys, you know, really, you know, black guys really speaking fast and, you know, in English and so forth. And it was actually the Sugar Hill Gang. I later learned this, Rapper's Delight. So for me, growing up as a kid, you know, I'd only learned English in school. I'd come and I knew other languages, but not English very well. I had come to believe that people who were dark, black people, did not speak English as well as. And here I saw somebody who was black and very versatile in this language. So that was very exciting to me. So then we wrote the name down, and then when my older brother went to school in Freetown, he kind of met other kids who were into this whole thing. So he brought tapes, you know, so we had Run DMC, El Kuji, Naughty by Nature. So we would put it in a cassette player with battery operated thing, and we would rewind it, and we would listen to the words, and we would try to write them down.
Wow.
And then if we couldn't figure out what a particular word meant, we would look in the dictionary to see what it meant. And if we couldn't find it, then we would kind of, you know, listen to the context and try to figure out what it meant. And so this really made us learn English very well and kind of look for new words. And then as we perfected that, we would start writing our own things. So we went to these variety shows where we would, like, mime Ella Kuji, I Need Love, and all that stuff, you know. It was quite funny. But my father would always say, whenever we're listening to these things, he would say, why don't you listen to the BBC? That's the proper English, you know. Why does?
And as it turned out, the rap tapes twice saved your life.
Yes, because what had happened in the context of this war in Sierra Leone, where children would walk to, you know, on paths 10 miles to other villages, would not fear anything, you know, your innocence was replaced with this tremendous fear that came from people, because what the rebels had started doing early on in the war was that they would have children kill their parents or people in their own towns and then burn their villages to stigmatize them so that they become, you know, attached to them, because there was nowhere they could go. And so when we were in a group of boys running away from the war,
everyone was afraid of us
because they thought we were part of one of those groups. So sometimes people would attack us, or sometimes people would run away from us.
Yeah, the phrase you used, you said this was one of the consequences of the Civil War. People stopped trusting each other and every stranger became an enemy. I don't know if you read recently Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It's a novel where a man and his son are walking through this devastated landscape, and what struck me so much was that you don't want to meet other people. It's not like you're looking for someone to help you. Anyone you meet is a potential, you know, because they're afraid of you. And that's just such a basic thing to think of being gone.
Yeah, and at that age,
right,
when everyone is afraid of you. And also, even people you knew but you hadn't seen for a while were afraid of how they related to you.
Because you might have switched over, you know, and
you might
be someone that they would have reason to fear.
Yeah, so that was very difficult to be in that context.
And how long did you, once the rebels came into that town and you and your friends decided to try and stay away, you know, to wander, how long were you wandering with this group of boys before you were in the town that was under the control of the army?
Well, first I was running with my older brother and Taloy and a few other kids, and then I lost them at some point, you know, and then I encountered another group of kids. It was seven of us. So we, between 12 and 13, so it was almost a year, I was running from the war. And between that time, my immediate family was killed, mother, father, and two brothers. And then I found myself at age 13 in a town where there was a disenfranchised group of the Sierra Leone army. And at first...
How did you describe them? A disenfranchised group of...
The Sierra Leone Army.
Sierra Leone Army.
Yes.
And this is where the conscription happens in this town, right?
Yes,
this
in Yile.
Yile, right. Yeah. And this is sort of the situation changed, because in a sense the military, the army, was protecting the town, although there was a kind of unease among the soldiers that you detected. But then something changed. I guess the rebels were closer.
Yeah.
And that when that scene where you're handed an AK-47 and your profound distress, because you knew what was coming. Is that right?
Yes, we knew what was coming, but at some point we couldn't really believe that this was going to happen, because, you know, as a young boy I was shorter than I am now and also skinnier, and I didn't think anyone would really want to use me for such a thing, because I didn't think I would be effective. Even some of the kids I was with were young, 9 and so forth. But you know, but you know, you were given this gun, and we were afraid to look at it, actually. But if you didn't accept it, you were killed. And sometimes when I talk about it, some people think, well, was there a choice? It wasn't like they said to you, hey, man, would you like to join us? You can walk around the block and think about it, you know. And, you know, it wasn't like that. It was that if you didn't join, you will get killed. So actually, accepting this and being a part of it was a way to stay alive.
Of course, and that conflict, I mean, your distress, you know, the migraine that you describe, I mean, there is no way out, and yet, you know, it's causing this incredible turmoil. They also, you wrote of the rebels, they have lost everything that makes them human, and I wonder, was that also true of the military? I mean, was there any difference in terms of how they treated civilians between the two sides?
No, there was no difference. At some point in the war, the only difference between the rebels and the army was that the rebels had a sort of signature, which was amputating people. But apart from that, you know, the soldiers were carrying out the same atrocities as the... and at some point, actually, this became quite blatant in 97, after I'd been removed from this war. You know, the rebels and the soldiers connived and overthrown the civilian government. So everyone was at the behest of this group. And there's actually a term that developed in Sierra Leone called Sobel, which is soldiers that behave like rebels. And this was a lot of them who did that, pillaged the countryside, and, you know, and that was it.
They also exploited your anger when this conscription happened. It was not that long after you had discovered the loss of your family in the town that had been burned. And one of the things it sounded like that they used to exploit the child soldiers is, you know, these are the people that killed your family. And then on top of that, there was the use of the brown.
Yes.
Exactly. Is that right?
That's right. Well, first, you know, how you recruit a child is that you destroy what they know. You kill their family, their towns, and everything. And then, you force them into this madness. You indoctrinate them by showing them lots of violence. And then you drug them up. And then you use this rhetoric, which they use to us, is that those rebels are not human. They're responsible for what happened to your family. You should stop them so that other children don't go through this. They don't deserve to live. You're performing a service for your country, and all of this stuff. At that point, when you're angry and you're traumatized, you're drugged up, you believe this. But as time goes on, you actually believe this. And also, as a young person, when you have lost everything that's dear to you, this group is the only slightly organized group in the context of when everything is disintegrated, traditions, cultures, families.
So it becomes a family in a certain sense.
It becomes like a surrogate family in a weird way, and you become quite attached to them. But one thing that was very difficult to learn later on after I was removed from this was the fact that that same rhetoric was used on the rebel side. They told them the soldiers are responsible for everything. They're responsible for everything that happened to you. And they don't deserve to live. And so the children who were recruited were also given that rhetoric on the other side. And we all believed it on opposite sides and hated each other severely.
When, you know, we have a friend in common, Sheikhou Mansouré, who's also Sierra Leonean, who was a victim of the amputations from the rebels, I believe.
Yes.
So when the two of you are together, and I see you as friends, I mean, is your understanding between, do you talk about what happened, or is it just like a given that you're both victims of the same civil war?
I think we both have an understanding that we're both victims, you know, like I was victimized to certain things that, you know, if I didn't do, I would die. And he didn't get pressed in the war, but he lost his hands.
Both lost your families.
And we both lost our families. But I think both of us meeting in New York and becoming friends, I think we understand what violence is. We understand what that is. And we understand that the only way to heal from this is to forgive.
Yes, I sense just a great kind of, a real camaraderie between the two of you. I mean, I know that you've both been through something, you know, through this cauldron.
Yeah. So when he and I, we talk about a war sometimes, you know, just, I think when we talk, we just reminisce about how beautiful our land was and what happened to that and that misfortune, rather than really dwelling on whether somebody should be, you know, I was there and he was there. But I think we have a very strong understanding that, you know, seeking revenge or being angry is not the way to live with these memories at all, because if that's very destructive to yourself and to the other person you're angry at. And we are great friends, and we.
Yeah, I see that.
And yeah,
for most combat veterans, I mean, adults, we're talking about the process of healing from, you know, post-traumatic stress, psychological damage is a lifelong process. That's what I was looking at in my book, The Souvenir. I'd like to know more about, you know, your process of rehabilitation. I mean, you talk about the resilience of children, particularly having gone through this one yourself. More resilient than adults? Do you feel like for yourself there's going to be a lifelong process going on, or in a sense, have you been through something that allows you to be forgiving? I mean, I've met vets, you know, who are, you know, from World War II, who are in their 70s and 80s now, and they are never going to forgive the Japanese, you know. What can you say about that resilience?
Well, first of all, I think the process of healing from war or any sort of trauma or violence is not as immediate as a lot of people think it is. You know,
not as immediate
as a lot of people think it is. I think through movies and some journalistic report, people have come to believe that you remove somebody from war, especially children, and they're fine. They go prancing in the sunlight or something. It's not that simple. The healing is difficult. It's a difficult and long process, which is why it requires commitment, sensitivity, and long-term care. But it's possible. You know, for example, when we came out of the war, it took us 2 months to just detox from all these drugs we were taking. Now, if somebody during those 2 months, we were so violent all the time, we hurt the people who were trying to help us, Now, if somebody would have given up on us in 2 months and say these kids cannot change because
and that would have been easy
months,
to do because
that would have been easy to do.
You guys were pretty hostile, you know.
We were
really hard
to
deal
put it
with.
Mildly, we were very bad. But you know, if somebody would have given up on us in 2 months, I wouldn't be here speaking in front of you because you know. But that's what I'm saying. It does. It's not as quick. It's possible, but it takes a time.
And the phrase that the nurse that she kept repeating that people this was not your fault. None of this was your fault. It's almost like you had to hear it. You know, you had to internalize it over a long time.
Well, one thing that you lose as a child, and you know, is that you during this war you learn to think that you're your best hope, your best, and that you distrust everything, especially adults. Mm. And so, for somebody to get closer to you, they have to gain that trust again for a while. But it's not your fault. The reason why we were so upset in the beginning is almost when you come from this world where you've developed. You've been conditioned to think of civilians and combatants as the combatant being responsible to do whatever they wanted to the civilian. Officer, the civilians are telling you it's not your fault, and also something that you've come to believe was the right thing to do is almost belittling you as a soldier. Mm. You know, so it gets very upsetting. But as time went on, it wasn't the "it's not your fault" itself; it was the genuine care, compassion behind it. These people, these Sierra Leoneans, were willing to look at us as children, regardless of what we were being forced to do, and nothing more. You know, we will hurt them, and when they return, they will say, "It's not your fault. Have you eaten?" So, you know, so these kinds of things, as time went on, it began to really sink in. It rekindled the humanity that was still within us.
Rekindled, that's a really good word. I mean, it really had to be rekindled again.
Yeah, like, it had to be. And the joy that we had known as children that lay dormant inside us had to be rekindled. And it was only through genuine care and somebody who was willing to be selfless and commit themselves to us. And these were the people who did that. Now, going back to, you know, people who don't forgive, really, I think children have the natural resilience to live through this because, first of all, they're younger and, you know, people can help them. But I think when adults come from certain wars sometimes, there's no process of rehabilitation because people think that if you're
That's
grown
right.
up, then you go into war, then you don't need rehabilitation. Everyone, when you are in a battlefield, when you see people, when you participate in taking people's life, you need to be rehabilitated. You cannot function very well because it doesn't sit with yourself when you do that. So sometimes when people are thrown just into society like that, they don't know how to live with those memories. They don't know how to deal with themselves. So because of that, they could be quite angry. They could not forgive anything. And also the reason why that happens is because I have come to believe, again, anyone can contend this point of view, is because if you heal people from wars that you're fighting, and you decide that somebody comes, they're traumatized in rehabilitation, it's almost like accepting that killing somebody for whatever reason, doesn't sit well with a human being. It's accepting that the people that you're fighting are as human as you are.
Right.
So oftentimes societies would not do that because it shows that there's something more to that, you know. So oftentimes they just put people into society because if you create those institutions, then you're saying that those people who are killing are affecting us, our culture as well.
Right.
So that's why people get so angry, because they have no way to bring a closure, to learn to live with this.
And that anger eats away.
It eats away at you. Yeah. That's basically what it does. If you don't forgive somebody, it's detrimental to yourself. Because, for example, if you hold your neighbor, if your neighbor hurts you and you hold them as a perpetual thief or as a perpetual killer, it doesn't make you comfortable living next to them, and you don't give them a chance to change it either.
Was there a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Sierra Leone?
Yes. It was formed alongside a special court that prosecuted people, and so people went and testified, and people tried to hear it and forgive and try to understand what came about.
Was it as successful, say, as in South Africa?
I'm not sure, because what happened at the end of Truth Commissions is that there are recommendations that are made that the government then puts out a white paper, kind of agreeing to change some of the things that caused the war, to not do it again. But in the context of Sierra Leone, the politicians went right back to doing those same things that caused the war.
And you were here, right, when it was going on over there?
The Truth Commission,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I was actually interning for an organization that was spearheading that, the ICTJ.
Ishmael, I wanted to ask you to read something so we could hear some of this language in your voice. And I was thinking, we talked about chapter 2. Is that good?
Yes. I want to go this way, Luke, because I think these people are not really seeing me.
Swing that around.
Sorry. That's better, yeah? Okay, good. Sorry about that. chapter 2. Well, just to preface this a little bit, this is, you know, when I'm living in New York now, and again, we were talking about the process of healing, how these memories followed me even after I came to live in the city, in the United States. I am pushing a rusty wheelbarrow in a town where the air smells of blood and burnt flesh. The breeze brings the faint cries of those whose last breaths are living their mangled bodies. I walk past them. Their arms and legs are missing. Their intestines spill out through the bullet holes in their stomachs. Brain matter comes out of their noses and ears. The flies are so excited and intoxicated that they fall on the pools of blood and die. The eyes of the nearly dead are redder than the blood that comes out of them, and it seems that their bones will tear through the skin of their taut faces at any minute. I turn my face to the ground to look at my feet. My tattered sneakers are soaked with blood, which seems to be running down my army shorts. I feel no physical pain, so I am not sure whether I have been wounded. I can feel the warmth of my AK-47's barrel on my back. I don't remember when I last fired it. It feels as if needles have been hammered into my brain, and it is hard to be sure whether it is day or night. The wheelbarrow in front of me contains a dead body wrapped in white bedsheets. I do not know why I am taking this particular body to the cemetery. When I arrive at the cemetery, I struggle to lift it from the wheelbarrow. It feels as if the body is resisting. I carried it in my arms, looking for a suitable place to lay it to rest. My body begins to ache, and I can't lift a foot without feeling a rush of pain from my toes to my spine. I collapse on the ground and hold the body in my arms. Blood spots begin to emerge on the white bedsheets covering it. Setting the body on the ground, I start to unwrap it, beginning at the feet. All the way up the neck, there are bullet holes. One bullet had crushed the Adam's apple and sent the remains of it to the back of the throat. I lift the cloth from the body's face. I am looking at my own. I lay sweating for a few minutes on the cool wooden floor where I had fallen before turning on the light so that I could completely free myself from the dream world. A piercing pain ran through my spine. I studied the red exposed brick wall of the room and tried to identify the rap music coming from a car passing by. A shudder racked my body, and I tried to think about my new life in New York City, where I had been for over a month. But my mind wandered across the Atlantic Ocean back to Sierra Leone. I saw myself holding an AK-47 and walking through a coffee farm with a squad that consisted of many boys and a few adults. We were on our way to attack a small town that had ammunition and food. As soon as we left the coffee farm, we unexpectedly ran into another armed group at a soccer field adjoining the ruins of what had once been a village. We opened fire until the last living being in the other group fell to the ground. We walked toward the dead bodies, giving each other high fives. The group had also consisted of young boys like us, but we didn't care about them. We took their food, ammunition, sat on their bodies, and started eating the food they had been carrying. I got up from the floor, soaked a white towel with a glass of water, and tied it around my head. I was afraid to fall asleep, but staying awake also brought back painful memories. Memories I sometimes wish I could wash away, even though I am aware that they are an important part of what my life is, who I am now. I stayed awake all night, anxiously waiting for daylight so that I could fully return to my new life, to rediscover the happiness I had known as a child, the joy that had stayed alive inside me, even through times when being alive itself became a burden. These days I live in three worlds, my dreams, the experiences of my new life, which trigger memories from the past.
Picturing you in New York, you know, a month into your new life, what a strange transition that is. When you first met Laura at the UN, did you first notice her telling a story? How did you? I think you talked about her even maybe telling an African story.
When I came to this, you know, thing at the UN, you know, my mom now was one of the facilitators, and everyone was introducing themselves. I'm the UNICEF psychologist, I'm this, I'm that. But this one woman, I remember very vividly, got up and said, I'm a storyteller. And now, you know, coming from a strong storytelling background, I was very curious how this woman in New York became a storyteller.
And you could have heard her here on the Aloud series. She is an amazing storyteller.
Yeah, I know that for a fact because I have a very high standard for storytelling.
I know. And so does she.
Yes. But, you know, and so, and also, so I wanted to talk to her. So I kind of formed a relationship with her because of that. But also because my friend, another kid, Alessine, who now lives in Canada, we had been sent to the U.S. without knowing where we were going. So without knowing it was winter. So we were wearing T-shirts and really, you know, little
in
tiny
York,
pants.
Were, oh, my God.
So we were sitting next to the radiator. We were really cold. And so she knew, she saw us. So she went home and got her jacket and gloves and hats and gave them to us. So we started forming a relationship because of that. And so, but after the conference ended, I went back to Sierra Leone. And so we kept in touch. And, you know, she sent me money to start school again. And you know, she wrote me letters from what she was doing. And I wrote her letters as well. And but then when the war came to the capital city, we lost touch for several months. But I remember going to the Red Cross, and because I wanted to get a message to her that I was fine. But at the Red Cross, the only way to get a message out was if somebody was your family. They wouldn't send it if you was your friend. So when I wrote the message down that I was okay, they said, well, what's your relationship? And I said, well, she's my friend. They were like, no, you're only family members. So when I changed it and I said, mother. Mm. And then I walked away and I thinking to myself, now this woman is really going to freak out when she gets this message, you know. And then she tells me the story now later when I came to live with her, that she got a call from the Red Cross and they said, we have a message from your son. And she wanted to say, I don't have a son. But then she realized she had met so many of us and she said, well, which one? And so they said, oh, Ishmael. So that's really when our relationship started going that way, I think she realized.
It really makes me believe in fate to think that you, from the storytelling culture and the storytelling family, found your way to a storytelling mother.
Yes. You know, I felt like part of my childhood was being given back to me because, you know, my mom is such a wonderful storyteller that she knows stories from all parts of the world. So when I came to live with her and, you know, before at night, she would tell me a story from Sierra Leone, from the Mende tribe, stories that I thought were so specific to my tribe that no one would know and know elsewhere. And she would tell me these stories. So, you know, it was really, it's quite
wonderful. She's not only a great storyteller, she's a real scholar of stories.
Yes.
She's really a great.
Oral tradition, folklore, very much so.
Yes. We recently had on this stage the other day as part of the program, I don't know if any of you were here for Philip Zimbardo. Anyone here for Mr. Zimbardo? He wrote this book, I was telling him about you, called The Lucifer Effect. He was an expert witness at Abu Ghraib, and he was talking about the ways to, you know, the book is the subtitle, you know, how good people can do evil things. And he was talking about the ways, you know, to condition yourself to resist, you know, as adults when you are drawn into these situations where you're going to get carried away or seduced by, you know, a situation where you might do something that you wouldn't want to do in your, quote, you know, right mind. And he talked about, one of the things he talked about was breaking the frame, like, you know, saying something to yourself like, how will I feel about this, you know, when I tell my grandchildren about it? How will I... And I was thinking with your riddle of the, I know this is a long question, but with your riddle of the monkey at the end, that you were really breaking the frame. That's what you're really doing. You're seeing a different way to look at this, at the situation. You're reframing the whole situation. And I wondered if you could read us the riddle of the monkey.
From the book?
Yeah.
Okay. Some of you haven't read the book.
Well, that is that bad to give?
Well, some people who haven't read the book,
No, maybe not. Maybe we'll just leave it.
Because I feel like I could give it away.
A traditional story that you're telling about how you saw a way to break through this riddle, and in a way, you are breaking. Your version is breaking the cycle of vengeance.
Yes, because I think what happens during the context of war is that once the violence erupts, once it starts, once you're inside it, there's no easy way out. There's a consequence that needs to be paid. Whether that means trauma, memories you have to live with for the rest of your life, people getting killed and things of that sort. So, and in order, revenge, what it does is that it's you never satisfy. In that context, when we went out to fight, you know, and did a lot of damage, we were never satisfied. The hurt didn't heal at all. So, and in the process, and in the process of going out and doing that, you know, if avenging the death of your loved ones, you also killed other people who didn't have anything to do with that, and so they too joined another side to do the same thing. So you create a whole circle of violence that continues. So someone has to stop at some
point.
Someone
has to stop.
Otherwise, this just becomes something that goes on and on, and that doesn't do anyone any good.
Well, that's why it's so important, and it's and that you've written this book, and that you were doing the speaking that you were doing because you're a witness to that madness.
Yeah, I mean, I just hope that, you know, I always say to people, I really hope that people can believe some of us who have lived through such things that, you know, war or violence of any sort, it's not good for anyone. That you don't have to live through it to appreciate life deeply and others as well, others' lives.
Why do you think, I mean, the book itself, of course, is so beautifully told, but why do you think Americans have responded so deeply to your book?
Well, I think there's one thing that I did was that when I was writing this book, I was aware from the get-go that I needed to write about how I felt then, not now, and unflinchingly, and just tell it in a matter-of-fact way, not try to sugarcoat anything. Because at that age, first of all, I didn't have any political views, so I didn't write very much about the politics. I didn't have any political views, so I didn't write very much about the politics that was going on at that time. And also, you know, I think what that does when you just write it and just honestly give it to people is that it creates a human connection to the story. Mm. So all of a sudden, it's not just a civil war. It's when somebody reads it, they can see themselves. They can see their child. They can see their friend. They can see it becomes more of a heart-to-heart connection with two human beings. Somebody suffers somewhere. It's not just a Sierra Leonean. It's not just an African. It becomes that deep. So from there arises a genuine care, a genuine concern. It touches people deeply. And, you know, I studied political science in school, and oftentimes when people say, oh, there was a civilian casualty in a war, that doesn't do very much for anyone's imagination. It's too loud.
Collateral damage.
That doesn't do anything for your imagination. But when you explain what that means, there was a family sitting together for dinner, and a child saw a bullet goes through their father's brain and he falls, what that happens to that child, all of a sudden it's not so distant anymore because it could be any family. So I think that's when I write, that's what I try to do. I just want to explain it and then people can see that, then they can make that human connection. Then it's not so distant anymore because people in Sierra Leone are as human as people in America. Or people in Colombia, where this is happening as well, as humans, people in America, we all want the same thing, send our children to school and live in peace, you know. And people there are not violent, and losing one's humanity in this context is not specific to Africans. Anyone, if you find yourself in that circumstances, you could do what we did or even worse. And I want, you know, and I think, you know, I think we've come to see that now that, you know.
Thank you. I think we're going to open it up to you. Ishmael, a chance to catch his breath. Margaret is back there in the striped shirt, and why don't we start over there?
I'd like to compliment you on your maturity and morality. It wasn't what I was expecting this evening. I haven't read your book. Could you tell me what was the hardest part of the transition back from child soldier to child? Was it the detoxification? Was it learning how to trust again? Was it something else?
I think, can everyone hear me well? It's good? Okay. I think the most difficult part is, you know, after the drugs and after everything, it's learning how to live with these memories, learning how to live with them and transform them so that they do not kill you. That is the most difficult part. But I think what I have come to learn along the ways is that I've come to be able, because of the people, the remarkable people in my life, I've come to be able to use my experiences more as instructional tools of how I live my life, how I appreciate my life, what I hold dearly. So for me, waking up in the morning is enough to be happy, which is why I'm always smiling. Because, I definitely appreciate, as I think of it, this second lifetime of mine. So that's the most difficult part, is learning to live with the memory. Because healing is not forgetting. I can never forget any of what happened to me, but I can learn to live with it in a positive way so that it doesn't handicap me.
Question? How about right there?
Hi. I was wondering whether or not you still keep in touch with your uncle's family and how they're faring now since the Civil War is over.
I actually went back to Sierra Leone last year, in June of last year. So I was able to find my cousins again. And
it was
so
the first time that you've
It was
been
the
there?
First time I'd been since I left. And regardless of what happened there, it's a beautiful country. I love it dearly. When I was there, I felt at peace. You know, Salon people there. Okay, Sierra Leone. It's a beautiful country. I love it dearly. Actually, one of the remarkable things that happened when I was there, I was able to sleep so deeply and so peacefully than I've ever been able to do after the war. So I think my body recognized where it was. There was a kind of closure coming, you know. And, you know, I love it dearly. I'll go back. And I found my cousins. And I got them, you know, Sierra Leone cell phones are very popular in Sierra Leone these days. So I got them cell phones. So they would text me like 3 a.m. in the morning. And they figured out how to text me. I didn't teach them that. So it's kind of sweet. So I like it. So.
How about up there? Either one or both?
Hi, I was wondering if you're able to sleep better now. But I also had a question. I'm a sixth grade teacher, and I teach the age level of you were when you were touched by war. And I'm considering teaching this book, but I don't know if I should. And I was wondering, do you think it would be appropriate to have sixth graders read this book? And if you did think it was appropriate, like, what would be the best way for me to present it? And hopefully in a way so that they can be aware of these issues and maybe even one day help to prevent these issues. So I don't know. I was just wondering your opinion on that.
It's quite a difficult question to really answer because, you know, I've always had an issue with this whole thing where, you know, we censor certain things for a certain age. You know, for example, we won't let, people in the United States won't let their children see certain things, but at the same time, they're children of that age who actually live in that reality. So I've always found it quite, and at the same time, I'm not advocating that all children should be traumatized as well, you know. So I don't really know where I stand on that issue, you know. It's a kind of really, difficult place to be. But what I would say is that read them the interesting parts, like the stories, and try and see how they take it. And I think it's something that each parent can do. What I would say, though, is that during the readings that I've been going around, actually, one thing that's been quite interesting is that kids who are 9, 10, 11, 12 have come with their parents, and someone actually read the book and introduced their parents to it. Mm. So, some of them do book reports, and they keep in touch with me to pass it by me and things of that sort. And it's quite sweet, you know. I'm not really sure what the appropriate thing, but all I would say is that when I was writing this book, one thing that I knew also was that I needed to give a strong sense of what happened there to people, to understand it. But also, I didn't want to handicap or traumatize people by reading this. So I kind of had to find a way to not give everything that happened day-to-day basis, because it's a fine balance. You want people to know, but you don't want to traumatize them. So I guess the kind of hard line that I take on that area is that, you know, if you don't want your children to see a visual depiction of these things or to learn stories of, to hear about these things, well, guess what? Maybe you shouldn't want those children to live it as well somewhere. So maybe you should do something about it, you know. So that's more of a tough area that I do go, but I'm a little ambivalent about the whole thing.
Let's come down over there.
You were talking about maintaining your humanity throughout this process, everything that you went through. And in some of the scenes, you were with other children. And you formed a very nice bonding group where you helped each other. You cared about them. And I was wondering if you thought that that helped you maintain that sense of humanity other than your selfness. Because in every group, when you were running away from the war, and then later when you were in the army, there were other children, somebody younger than you, that you cared for, you took care of. And I wondered if that helped to maintain those feelings of, like you said, humanness.
Yes, I think that definitely helped, because then it was not just surviving for yourself, it was also you're supporting other people. But also, that also helped in the sense that, in a very weird way, belonging to these groups, that they become your surrogate family. So like the lieutenant was like a father figure to us, and he looked down upon us as that as well. And also being part of this group, you wanted them to stay alive so you can have this community of mad people, basically. But nonetheless, it was a community. So I think there was still that sort of sense of caring for something, but in a very manipulative and weird way. But yeah.
In the middle here, Margaret? Yes.
But talk as I Creole.
And you speak as small boa.
Mister, we got you.
Kind of ma. Oh, yeah.
Ah, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're just speaking some local languages. Excuse us.
We're speaking Mende and Creole. Yes, so my question to you is, I'm Sierra Leonean American. I was born here, but my parents are Sierra Leonean. I've gone to Sierra Leone all of my life. Mm-hmm. Pre-war, post-war, it was so funny because this December was my first time being to Matruzhong. So I was able to go there, and it was surreal trying to, you know, live it through the book. And so being able to look at it from that context, my question for you is, you said such a great word, resilience, just seeing the people and seeing how strong we are. I think resilience is in our blood. So my question for you is, what is your dream for Sierra Leone now?
Somebody loves that question. What is my dream from Sierra Leone now? Well, one of the things that I'm doing alongside the book is starting a foundation that's called the Ishmael Bear Foundation. That's it's incorporated. There's a IshmaelBearFoundation.org. There's an under construction sign, and basically what we're doing, we're providing vocational and educational opportunities for children who've been affected by war. Not just child soldiers, any child whose life came to a stop because of this war. And this is my way of giving back to my country. And I'm not doing it out of guilt. I'm doing it out of a strong sense of responsibility for my country, for my land. Because I think one of the dangerous things about these wars, that when everyone, you know, flees these countries, is that we come here, we get educated, and we stay. And we don't go back. And that's actually detrimental to the future of our countries as well. And you don't have to be a politician. You can give back through so many different avenues. And I'm trying to encourage a lot of Sierra Leoneans to do that as well. So my goal, you know, I really want Sierra Leone to be a place that I want to go back to all the time. I'm going to have a home there as long as I'm alive. It will always be my home, and I hold it dearly. And therefore, I will do whatever I can to help those who are there as well.
How about over here?
I was just wondering how you feel towards your lieutenant now. Do you did you ever have any negative feelings towards him, or did you ever feel like he was the reason that you turned into a child soldier?
Actually, when I was removed from the war the first time, I was absolutely upset. I felt deceived because I believed that I was so much part of this group. So I hated the lieutenant after that. And then after I healed from the war, I was also mad that I had been robbed of my childhood. But then I thought about it and I said, well, you know, he also had lost himself in that war, just as we did, even though he was an adult. And one thing that recently somebody asked me during a reading that was very powerful, he said, did you ever consider that the lieutenant had also lost his childhood as a child because he was so drawn to Shakespeare that he had read as a child, that I had read as a child, and we got close because of that. And I thought that was so powerful because I didn't even think of that, but he had also lost himself in that way. So if anything, I feel compassion for him, and I would want to understand what made him do certain things rather than hate him for it. I would want to speak to him, and if I could find him.
Right here.
There are so many questions I think one could ask, but I'd like to, you talk about a sense of responsibility you feel and you sort of try and elicit in others towards Sierra Leone because of the bond you have with that country. But everybody here tonight, having read the book, what action would you ask us to do? Or in buying the book, obviously we've donated, I think, $2 to UNICEF, that's one thing. But now, have you... In a more political sense, a more activist sense, what could we do, having read the book, sort of to make sure this doesn't happen again?
Okay, more political active sense. What? First of all, there are several things that you can do. Is to not think of this as the history 101 about child soldiery and about Sierra Leone. That there is more information about this. So to empower yourself with more information, there are several ways of looking at what happened in Sierra Leone. This is just one point of view. And what that does for you when you empower yourself with information, you're in a position to find the right places to really help, to do certain things. One thing that you can do now, the Human Rights Watch is actually supporting this, is that there's a bill that's going to be put in front of the Senate that actually presses the United States government to stop giving military aid.
And there's literature on it out there.
There's literature on it out there that to stop giving military aid to countries that recruit children or that allow children to be recruited in their countries. And this could help tremendously because they still do give military aid to places where children are used in war. So that's one thing you can do. Another thing is to also, you can write a letter to your senator. You'll get information out there. One thing that you can do also is to press your government to support certain international treaties, legal standards that prevent the use of children in war. Because what that does is that, for example, if there hadn't been some treaties in place that say you can't recruit children, it wouldn't have given the courage to certain people who work at UNICEF to march up to the commanders and talk to them to release certain kids. So that's why these rules need to be strengthened, because people can do that for children. For some people in the United States, I know people have their mixed feelings about the United Nations and UNICEF and other agencies about their ineffectiveness and so on and so forth. For some of us, these are the institutions that come to our aid when no one does come to our aid. So when they're very, it's very important that they exist for us. So that's something that you can support and make sure that that continues. Because for some of us, if it wasn't in place, we would not survive. So these are some of the places you can start with your political things. And if that's not still you want to do more, then at the end you can give me your wallet. And no, I'm kidding. You can donate to the Ishmael Bear Foundation or other organizations. There are several organizations, some of them providing, raising money to provide, prosthetic for people who are amputated and things like that. Just go online and find more information, and there are ways you can help. And if you want to volunteer in Sierra Leone, you can go there. The weather is nice. The music is great. The food is amazing. There's nothing you will miss from being here. So you can do that as well.
We take a couple more questions. When we come over here, this gentleman here. Right there.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bay. I read your book. A total stranger gave me your book to read. And afterwards, I'd like for you to make a dedication to him. I'm going to return it. And but I noticed that you mentioned your connection to the African American experience was only evident in your rap music. And I'm wondering if you've made any further connections with the African American community here, or if you see any parallels with your experience in Sierra Leone and the African American community's experience in this country.
I actually, you know, when I moved to this country, you know, my mother is Jewish, so I've been able to be closer to more Jewish folks than anything else.
Happy Passover.
But, you know, at the same time, you know, I live in New York, so I have friends from all sides of the spectrum. But my connection, though, to the African-American, especially the young people, is that when I was in San Francisco last time, I went to the Alameda County Juvenile Hall, where there are a lot of young African-American kids and some Asian kids from 13 to 17 who were held there for being in gangs and things that they... And so what the publisher had done is that they had sent the book to them to read. So I went to speak to them. And basically we talked. I didn't talk to them. And we kind of talk about our experiences and see parallel connections and things like that. There are similarities. Ours was beyond control and more violent. But the idea of seeking a group that can look after you when you've lost everything was very similar. And being caught up in a world of violence that limits you from knowing yourself as a human being or knowing what you're capable of came through. But one thing that struck me, which I've always known that people can heal from whatever from these kinds of things, is that these young people were the most intelligent people I've ever met in my life. But they are put away. So if you don't go to see them, you will never see that. You only hear of it. So which goes to say that rehabilitation is really the only effective way. Because if they're there, they can't do anything. One of the kids said something to me that was so powerful. He said, when I'm here, I believe in words. Because when I write what I want to be or what my life could be like out of here, it becomes real for me. So the power of words actually make me live through here. And I was like, now this is a kid that's incarcerated, that it's put in this place for a crime. And he's saying this profound thing. But no one will ever get to see that if you don't go to see them or if you don't rehabilitate them. So I was deeply touched by doing that.
Ishmael, we're going to bring it to a close now because I know a lot of you want to have your books on. I want to thank you for touching us so deeply, for your generosity and compassion, and for writing this very important and beautiful book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.